On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For century after century, the stained glass cathedral was the biggest, most dazzling cultural center in the Western world, and the church was the keeper of culture. Tonight, the Da Vinci Code hits theaters across the country, and the Megaplex is staring down the House of God. Dan Brown's high-conspiracy, Bible-twisting murder mystery, with its married Jesus and pregnant Mary Magdalene and heirs of Christ roaming the earth, has sold 60 million copies in print. Now it hits the big screen with Tom Hanks in a Pulp Fiction frontal assault on orthodoxy. In a moment, we'll hear from top theologians and from Catholic Archbishop George Niederauer of San Francisco. Joining me first from New York is Devin Gordon, senior writer at Newsweek magazine, who's been following the endless hubbub around the Da Vinci Code. Devin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's sort of, you cannot go anywhere on this planet today without some of this going on. China with its early premiere, India saying it can't be shown here, then it can. Manila saying no way, no how, we're not showing it here. Unbelievable.
Yeah, put it this way. I mean, I've done, half a dozen interviews about this so far. All my friends are emailing me about it. My parents are wondering about it. And I'm working on other stories this week, and it's something I can't seem to get away from. Half of my time has been Da Vinci Code.
What has the church's response been? Can you give us a sense, formally or globally? How has the church come back at this?
Well, the Vatican itself has taken a pretty measured response. I mean, I think that they don't want people to go see the movie. I think that they'd prefer if they didn't. But I think that they've also shrewdly recognized that an overreaction only plays into the movie's hands and only plays into the publicity's hands. You know, they've learned their lesson over the years with these things, and know that when you make a fuss, it makes you look like you're worried about something. And the best way to approach something that is ultimately just a popcorn silly movie is to remind people that it's a popcorn silly movie.
It opened at Cannes. It's had very mixed reviews, I have to say, coming out of there. I mean, Roger Ebert says the movie works. But we've got a whole lot of, you know, lifeless, fatally short on thrills, plodding, tedious, deathly dull, clueless, the Chicago Tribune says. Have you seen it yet, Devin?
Yeah, I saw it Wednesday night, and I think I'd probably fall more to the Roger Ebert spectrum of things. I mean, I think that there's a, you know, when people read reviews of the Da Vinci Code movie, I think that there are two things they need to bear in mind. First of all, most of the people writing these negative reviews are people who either didn't read the book or read the book and loathed it, so they're probably loath to like the movie anyway.
Predisposed to not like it.
Predisposed to dislike the movie. And second, that critics have a different job than the average moviegoer. The critic's job is to sort of, you know, defend the gates of the film pantheon and make sure that nothing unworthy gets in. And the Da Vinci Code movie is clearly not worthy of being a classic or considered a great movie. But as far as popcorn, as far as whether or not the average audience moviegoer is going to go and see the movie and have a pretty good time, well, yeah, I think they're going to. I don't think the movie's nearly as bad as some of the reviews have made it out to be.
There, of course, has grown up a huge industry of counter Da Vinci Code material. It's all over the web, a dozen books out about it. You've got board games and card games and everything else coming out here. What's your sense here, Devin? You watch these big cultural things. I mean, here the church is taking on kind of the publishing industry, now Hollywood, the movie industry, mega media. And we've got, I'm reading all kinds of reports of church people saying, you know what, this may be fiction, but it's creeping into the minds of our flock. They're infected with something we can't control here.
Well, I think, you know, I'm sympathetic to the notion that it's creeping into the minds of some people, but I think there's an old saying, the wise general knows when not to fight. And this is one of those occasions when I think that the portions of the Catholic Church who have chosen not to combat this, but to see it as an opportunity to talk about these things and sort of gently and scholarly remind people what is fact and what is fiction, or at least is what is fact and fiction in their eyes, is the right approach. We're talking about a religion that has millions and millions of followers worldwide, that is 2 millennia old, and is not going to be brought down by Dan Brown, is not going to be brought down by Tom Hanks or Ron Howard. It will survive just fine. And a measured response to a work of fiction, I think, is the smart strategy. And to a large degree, I think that that's the approach they've followed. I think that they've managed to keep it under control and not sound all the alarms, which just makes it look like you've got something you're really, really worried about.
Devin Gordon in New York,
senior writer with Newsweek. Thanks very much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
We're talking about Da Vinci Code mania and the clash here between the church and maybe the modern media machine, as with 60 million copies in print and the movie hitting the theaters tonight. Joining me now in the studio, and I should say, we will hear a little bit later in this hour from the Archbishop of San Francisco, Roman Catholic Archbishop Gordon Niederauer. But right now with me in the studio is Karen King. She's a professor of ecclesiastical history at Harvard Divinity School, author of The Gospel of Mary of Magdala, Jesus and the First Woman Apostle, and What is Gnosticism? Karen King, thanks for being with us again.
Oh, my pleasure.
Also with us from Navarra, Florida, is Luke Timothy Johnson, professor of New Testament and Christian Origins at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. He's author of numerous books, including The Real Jesus, The Misguided Quest for the Historical Jesus, and The Truth of the Traditional Gospels. Luke Timothy Johnson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So here we are. It must drive, Mr. Johnson, Professor Johnson, must drive somebody like you crazy to see the giant megaphone of contemporary media put up to Dan Brown's work of fiction.
Well, it certainly is something of an irritant. It's part of a much larger phenomenon, I think, of what might be called a sort of internal erosion within the Christian community concerning its own identity. I think part of Dan Brown's cleverness was to catch on to something that was already fairly well advanced, which was a sort of deep suspicion of institutional religion in this country and in other places. And today we see people much preferring a kind of a broad, general spirituality to organized religion. And to put this within the framework of an ancient and modern conspiracy works very well in the kind of Robert Ludlum mode of religious reporting.
But people didn't really turn to Robert Ludlum for their understanding of these ancient stories. And now, as you say, there is a kind of openness here. You've said it's as though people are prepared to get their spirituality at Barnes and Noble's today. You've called it pop religion. Why the strength of that?
I think it's several things. So one is, I think from somebody who takes seriously the sort of tradition of Christianity, I think this is a tremendous wake-up call for better preaching, better teaching within Christian communities. I think that the fact that people are so easily sort of swayed or attracted to what is clearly sort of an ersatz form of scholarship in this, not even scholarship in this regard, bad fiction, I would call it, indicates a lack of formation, I think, within the Christian tradition, and it's a wake-up call for better catechesis, better preaching, and better historical consciousness. One of the things that I think is happening is that we have a far more literate, far more educated lay population than ever before, and correspondingly, a less well-educated, a less literate clergy. And people tend to go to Barnes and Nobles for their information and their instruction rather than the local pastor. Mm. And there's reasons for that. Mm.
But as you say, part of this may grow out of a kind of ahistorical, opened-up conversation within the community of the faithful and theologians themselves in recent years. Karen King is with me here in the studio, and I think you two, Karen, and Luke Timothy Johnson may represent some of the sides in that. I mean, and I should say right from the get-go, you were a paid consultant for this movie, but in part because you've done some of this scholarship, which takes a more open-minded view of what actually happened 2 millennia ago.
That's right. I mean, the work that I do has to do with, I think, focuses on women and heresy. My specialty is working with some of these new texts that we found in Egypt over the last 100 years. And I think they do allow us to have a different kind of view of early Christianity. That is to say, they allow us to see that Christianity wasn't fixed from the beginning, you know, and then, you know, heresies deviated from that. But they allow us to see the process by which certain kinds of problems and questions, including things like sexuality, the roles of women, the meaning of Jesus' teachings, the meaning of his death and resurrection, these kinds of things really were being early Christians were trying to understand them. We're really trying to get at them. And so we have multiple voices.
So when you see a huge bestseller like this, now headed for the theaters in the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's work, do you see this as a kind of welcome opening up of the conversation, or is this the, you know, from the kind of tone of the trailer we heard at the top, is this the demon spawn of more broad-minded scholarship like your own?
Well, I think that any broad-based film like this is always an opportunity for education. And on that, Luke Timothy Johnson and I would agree. Where we would disagree, I think, is about what exactly it is that people want to know, where this is coming from and what that's about. I myself would say, for example, that the kind of criticism that's coming would be more welcome, would perhaps be more balanced if it were applied equally, for example, let's say to Mel Gibson's Passion, if people wanted to know about the fiction behind what's presented there as facts, about the kind of tendentious theology, or even about the kind of bigotry of religion, in that case anti-Judaism rather than anti-Catholicism.
In the film, Leonardo da Vinci leaves clues everywhere. Even his famous painting of The Last Supper has some here. Sir Lee Teabing, played by Ian McKellen, helps Sophie Nouveau, played by Audrey Tautou, decipher da Vinci's hidden message.
Now, mademoiselle, where is Jesus sitting?
In the middle.
Good. He and his disciples are breaking bread. And what drink?
Wine. He drank wine.
Splendid. And one final question. How many wine glasses are there on the table?
One. The Holy Grail.
Open your eyes. No single cup. No chalice. Well, that's a bit strange, isn't it? Considering both the Bible and standard Grail legends celebrate this moment as the definitive arrival of the Holy Grail.
There it is from the movie. It opens tonight, and it's almost guaranteed to be a blockbuster, given the tens of millions of people who have read the book. At our website, by the way, you can see a gallery of images from the Da Vinci Code and the hubbub around it, European landmarks, and links to reviews, all at onpointradio.org. I've been joined in this hour by Karen King, professor of ecclesiastical history at Harvard Divinity School, by Luke Timothy Johnson, professor of New Testament and Christian origins at Emory University. We're joined right now from Salt Lake City by the Archbishop of San Francisco, Archbishop George Niederauer. Archbishop, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
How are you and your flock taking this on board? How do you look at this hubbub?
Well, I think there are probably all sorts of different reactions, even by officials in the church. One archbishop in Rome has called for a boycott. Somebody in Hollywood has called for an other cot. In other words, go see another movie.
Right.
I think Cardinal Regali of Philadelphia has a good point that it's fiction. It's maybe a teaching moment for the church to try to separate truth from fiction. And then there are those who would like to take legal action. And then, of course, an outsider sometimes has an excellent view. Rabbi Edwin Goldberg from Florida says, well, 1,000 years from now, God willing, people will be talking about the Bible, but no one will be talking about Dan Brown. So we'd have to wait 1,000 years to find out the truth.
God willing, you say. I'm glad you're still good-humored about it. You wrote an essay, Archbishop, that you led off with a quote from Mark Twain saying, a lie is halfway around the world while the truth is still putting its boots on.
Yes, that's right. I like that.
Can the church compete with modern media, with Hollywood, with blockbuster books like this that, you know, information now travels at the speed of light? Once upon a time, you and the clerics kind of had a lock on universal communication. No more.
That's very true. I think in a multimedia and a very rapid media age, rules and the practice change. But I think, quite frankly, that parents are the first and most important religious educators of their children, and the home is still pretty private and sacred, even though there are computer terminals in almost every room. And I think it's really that the faith, Catholic faith, is passed on from generation to generation by parents, certainly guided by priests and ministers of the church. But ultimately, it is something that that children pass on to their parents.
Not that private in the home, though. And we're looking here at new polls out of the UK saying that a majority of readers of the book now believe that there was a relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene, that Jesus may well have had offspring. You cite in your essay examples that you yourself have heard of the faithful's heads being turned by this story.
I think that's true. I tell the story that one young graduate of a Catholic high school out here was talking to a classmate who said she was thinking of giving up her faith because of reading the book, and he said, well, you would give up your faith for a novel? And she said, well, but it's all true. So I think what the church has to counter and say, well, no, it's not all true. Truth is often stranger than fiction, because fiction is something we make for ourselves to suit ourselves. Truth is truth, whether we like it being true or not.
Karen King, let me turn to you. Here in the Archbishop is kind of the voice of the Roman Catholic Church. Your scholarship has poked and prodded an awful lot at the traditional Orthodox version of history here, and for that matter, of the core religious story in Christianity. The Archbishop Niederauer says families will deal with this and should. But you are really promoting, in a way, the opening up of the story. Are you two at loggerheads?
Well, I think that one of the core issues around people reading the Da Vinci Code and part of its attractiveness is precisely issues about marriage and sexuality. There is a certain attractiveness in seeing, a heterosexual family at the core of the Christian story. I think a lot of people in the modern world are questioning, what Christianity teaches about sexuality, in particular about things like women's leadership and ordination, about issues of celibacy as being any kind of ideal model of purity and so forth in our society and world. I think that's speaking less to people. My work
The book, The Da Vinci Code, suggests that there was a much larger role for women. Mary Magdalene, very big in that. And that honest, genuine tradition, in the book's representation of it, was kind of hijacked by the patriarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. Are you suggesting that is true?
Well, the book is actually saying that is offering a view of positive view, or trying to offer a positive view of femininity and sexuality, of male and femaleness as wholeness. Now, but not, of course, in terms of women's leadership and being ordained and so forth. But if you look at the early church, what we see is a wide range of views on this issue. Celibacy really didn't develop in the priesthood until much later. We see women as leaders. Mary Magdalene was one of those. And what I dislike seeing is precisely our resexualizing of her. We had her as a repentant prostitute. The church taught that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, the Catholic Church and others have agreed that was the story was not true. And now what we see is resexualizing her as a wife and mother, when what the historical evidence shows us best is Mary Magdalene as a loyal disciple of Jesus. And therefore, she can be seen as someone to whom women can appeal for leadership roles.
Luke Timothy Johnson, are you willing to look at the historical record here? Is that relevant in your teaching of an understanding of the theology?
Well, I'd like to begin by saying that I agree with Professor King with respect to the Mel Gibson's movie, and I agree with her wholeheartedly that
in what respect exactly
remarks should be put in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
But in response to the point made about Mary Magdalene and sexuality, I think that one of the disappointing aspects of the book is, as Professor King suggests, to diminish Mary Magdalene's role as witness and interpreter, which is also found in the canonical Gospels. Her primary function is as a witness and a disciple, not being married to Jesus and having children. In some sense, this, in my view, does not represent a liberating moment for women. Now, with respect to the historical record, of course, we always are instructed by ancient documents, and such archaeological discoveries as the recent Judas Gospel and so forth are always of deep interest to the historian. One of the things that I think is problematic about the present conversation is that the heart of the Christian belief, which is in the resurrection of Jesus and the power of that resurrection continuing in the lives of people today, tends to be displaced by a preoccupation about what happened when and where. It's not that history is not important. It is not necessarily important for theology or for the structure of faith. The resurrection of Jesus is not, in traditional Christian teaching, really a historical event. It's an eschatological event. It transcends history.
Archbishop, the Catholic Church, of course, was built around a central role for males. Do you see in the popularity of this book and perhaps the movie soon a kind of, revenge of the sacred feminine? If you bottle it up, does it come roaring back out today of modern media? Did the Church cut itself off from some of its more feminine roots?
I don't think so. I think just to take as a case Mary Magdalene, Rosemary Ruther is takes no back seat as a Catholic woman to other feminists, and she kind of scoffs at the notion of a conspiracy against Mary Magdalene. She takes note that there's a very positive treatment by Ambrose and Augustine, and that's in the 4th and the 5th century. So that really, I think there's a great veneration for her. The Eastern Catholic churches were fond of calling her the Apostle to the Apostles, because she was the one who brought the witness of the resurrection to the apostles who had not yet seen the risen Christ, to point up again the importance of the resurrection, as Dr. Johnson points out.
And of course, now we have a story woven all through that. And she's not just the apostle of the apostles. She is essentially the wife of Jesus, the bearer of a child. The bloodline ends up in France and in royalty and right down to the current age in the story of the Da Vinci Code. I want to turn to our listeners. Laura's calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
We're fine. What do you think of all this, Laura?
Well, I have to be real honest. Being a Christian, I cannot support this movie, mainly because it blasphemes the name of the Lord in which I serve. The Bible is clear that Jesus never got married, was never intimate with anyone, and therefore it's a shame that people who profess the name of Christ would go and support a film that blasphemes his name.
That's a pretty straightforward perspective. Archbishop, what are you advising your flock? To see it, to not see it, to boycott it?
Well, I think I would advise my flock, whether they see it or not, is to brush aside the argument they often hear, well, it's just entertainment, don't take it so seriously. I think we have to recognize that entertaining, well-made films can still be socially obnoxious in content, even bigoted. I think of a couple in the past. Birth of a Nation, the great D.W. Griffith masterpiece, still offends an African-American audience because it glorifies the Ku Klux Klan. Triumph of the Will, which has great cinematography from the 1930s, Leni Riefenstahl's movie, offends lots of audiences because it glorifies the Nazi Party. You can make a very entertaining and riveting film and still get across a message that is really rather offensive. The hero says to the heroine in the book, I haven't seen the film, the hero says to the heroine, almost everything our fathers taught us about Christ is false. Well, that doesn't make it a typical airport or beachfront novel. It really does give offense.
Laura, thank you very much for your call. Let me get another call here. Wendy's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I am also, I would consider myself a disciple of Christ in the Orthodox view of who Christ is as the Son of the Father, and there is a Holy Spirit. That's the context in which I'm speaking. And I actually did read the book. And when I got to the part about, you know, Jesus being married, I scratched my head and I was like, where is this coming from? And I did read the preface. It says, much of this is based on fact.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was a page-turner for me. I enjoyed every single page of it. There was a little voice in the back of my head that said, I wouldn't give this to a green sapling disciple because this might be a bit jarring.
But what was was it the thrill of reading blasphemy or just for you a good murder mystery?
No, it was a good story. It was just purely a good story, a page turner, a good story. But it was, like I say, a head scratcher. And in terms of the controversy about it, I personally think it's a grand opportunity to have conversations with people. It's very uncomfortable as a disciple of Christ to say the name Jesus in a public forum of whatever, at the lunch table, wherever. People's eyes glaze over. They kind of sit back a little bit, and they just look at you like, oh, dear God, she's going to say something really, you know, she's going to thump the Bible or do something really strange.
Maybe where you live, but in a lot of corners it's not like that. But anyway, yeah.
This is just great, an opportunity to actually say the name, talk about it, hear what people's views are. There are, like, you know, other people have said, many people are going, wow, I never knew Christianity was so cool. This is something I could really get behind. And I just want to say, well, let me just kind of share some of my views about the historicity and the different items that have been brought up and my view of it, and let's just have a dialogue. As a woman who would like to consider myself educated and willing, I want to be able to hold two thoughts in my head that are completely different and not necessarily be tied to either one, but be open.
We've got it. We've got it, Wendy, and we appreciate your calling with it. Thanks very much, Karen King. What about it? First of all, in your view, as a rather broad-minded theologian, is this book, is this movie blasphemy?
I think the thing that's probably significantly most disturbing and what the film brings out is it turns it into kind of a question between was Jesus fully human or was he fully divine? And, of course, the position of the church has always been both. You know, there is no evidence one way or another in the New Testament about whether Jesus was married. And that kind of silence always leaves open an option. Now, when you turn to the Catholic Church, I would say that this question that Professor Johnson brings up, how important is history? Well, history has been pointed to again and again that Jesus was celibate as precisely a way to argue that the leadership of the church must be both male and celibate. And that has excluded women from roles of leadership.
Are you saying you doubt that he was celibate? Are you saying that was superimposed by a church wanting to justify its own way?
I would say for the first century and for the New Testament writers in the first century, the whole issue about Jesus' marital status or celibacy was irrelevant, and that's why they didn't mention it. They were much more focused on his teaching.
Luke Timothy Johnson, what about this issue of his marital status and celibacy? Is that critical to an understanding of the biblical Jesus, to the traditional Christian way?
I don't think that it is critical to the understanding of Jesus as fully human and revealing God. I agree with Professor King that ancient interpreters of Jesus were far less taken up with issues of sexuality than we tend to be today. I think that part of the difficulty here is precisely the sort of pan-sexualization of our consciousness. The radical character of Jesus had very little to do with whether he was married or not married. The radical character of Jesus is that he brought a message concerning the turning about of social values and the way in which we deal with other humans, which continues to challenge us today.
Luke Timothy Johnson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's listen just a little bit here to some tape from Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code. Here he was speaking just about a month ago at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He was talking about the response he's received from women in the church.
Several nuns have told me that reading this novel gave them the strength to speak out on a forbidden topic, being that nuns pledged their entire lives to the church, figuratively married themselves to Jesus, dedicate all of their energies to their faith, and yet their church still declares them unfit to be priests, simply because they are women. How can this be? In my mind, there really is no fair answer.
And here, Da Vinci Code author Dan Brown responds to a question at the same forum about whether Christianity has anything to fear from the influence of his book.
Christian theology has survived the writings of Galileo and the writings of Darwin. Surely it will survive the writings of some novelist from New Hampshire. So, thank you.
Archbishop Niederauer, what do you say to that? The church has survived Galileo and Darwin. It will survive this. Is it that simple?
I don't know if it's that simple. We also survived the Emperor Diocletian very early on. So, sure, attacks and persecutions and the like sometimes make the church stronger. I think probably it's true to say that when this movie leaves the screens and goes into the into Blockbuster, several months from now, there probably will be as many people worshiping as Catholics on Sunday and taking their children to Catholic school and teaching them their prayers and expressing their faith in good works and charitable institutions as there were 6 months ago. I think to that extent, it's probably true.
Karen King, what about it? It will make the church stronger. Do you agree, A, and B, do you want the church to be stronger in its traditional garb, or do you want the church changed? Do you want it different?
Well, of course, I'm speaking as an Episcopalian and not as a Catholic. In my tradition, we do ordain women. I think that's a tremendous strength for us to have those talents that women have given to the church over the last 2,000 years, acknowledged in leadership roles. So to that extent, I'd like to see that franchise, of course, for all who are called to that kind of role in the church, to have a place for it.
But the fundamental story and understanding of Jesus and his life and those around him, are you looking for that to be changed off the dime of where it's been for more than a millennium?
Well, when we look at the history of the early church over particularly over the first couple of centuries, what we could see is certain kinds of issues being debated. Those same issues are still being debated today. Issues about sexuality, the roles of women, and so forth. I think it's extraordinarily healthy for contemporary religious communities for people to be given a sense of permission, if you will, to bring up their questions, to talk about these things, to work through them theologically. I wouldn't put the whole onus on pastors. I would say that precisely people in a democratic society have access to a wide variety of issues for debate, and it's extraordinarily healthy that these kinds of things are being debated. That Dan Brown's book is a catalyst for that, that he has this kind of, not only Dan Brown, but the movie picture and the Gospel of Judas and so on and so forth, have this huge media behind them, of course, presses those issues, but they wouldn't have them if people weren't wanting to have this debate, wanting to have this kind of talk.
Archbishop, extraordinarily healthy, this big kind of across-the-board walk debate and conversation that everything from the Gospel of Judas to the Da Vinci Code has on the table. As a man in the church, do you see it that way, as extraordinarily healthy?
I think it's healthy always to have discussion and dialogue, and I think I agree with John Henry Cardinal Newman from the 19th century that 1,000 difficulties don't make a doubt. One can have difficulty, wrestle with the teachings of one's faith, and still try to work that through and work it through with others. I think that it's important for us to ask questions, but always I think we have to recognize that traditionally, as Christians, we have believed, and I think this is true for those who are of the Jewish faith as well as Islamic faith, that we see revelation from God. We see God disclosing himself by revealing himself through holy books, through prophets. We don't see that we manufacture our religion for ourselves, that we make up teachings or modifications of teachings from the past to suit ourselves, because we are really the originators of religion. I think that that is a particular rock upon which some of these waves of discussion break. Where does religion come from? Is it just an expression of the yearnings of ourselves, and so we make up our gods and goddesses as we go along and change them as we change? Or is there really a truth revealed from God about himself, his love for us, his creation of us, his call to us to serve him and one another? And does he take the initiative, in other words, or do we?
Of course, the big part of the debate here is whether that revealed truth is coming through clear glass or stained glass. I want to take a caller from Berlin, Germany. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Thanks. I just had one question, which is sort of getting a little bit away from the idea of Christ or Jesus having a wife and kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's more the idea of, how does why should people get so upset about this sort of discussion or this sort of hypothesis? Because you're getting away from the historical aspects of a man's life, which, and the mythological aspects, which, or metaphysical aspects, which sort of help to base the religion or base one's system of belief.
But isn't that exactly why people are upset? Because for centuries, the story as handed down was accepted purely as fact, and many still do today. They don't want to see that gap open up.
Yeah, well, isn't that? But that's what I'm asking. Don't folks think who are on your panel there think that it might be more interesting to get away from the idea of, you know, our story is the only story.
But then you're saying it's a myth. You're calling the Bible mythology, which, of course, many people don't like that presentation of it.
Right.
Karen King, how about it? I can't help wondering if theologians in your camp aren't, in fact, kind of on the same beam as Paul here, ready to chip away at the Bible until the field is much more open and fluid. I mean, is part of the goal of your work, to, in fact, to bring down this text and open up the conversation to a new interpretation.
Well, I think both Paul and the Archbishop have a point in that they're focusing on how do we interpret scriptures and how are scriptures read. Now, in my tradition, it's Jesus himself who is the revelation of God in the world. He's considered fully human, fully divine. And in part of being fully human, the question that becomes is sexuality a part of being fully human? So these are theological kinds of questions. But I would certainly understand scripture as having been written by Christians struggling with these kinds of questions.
But
in
when you say
sense,
scripture, you're talking about more than the Bible, as I understand your work.
No, I'm not in this case. In this case, okay. I'm really talking about the New Testament.
Okay.
You know, mm-hmm. you know, the New Testament Gospels or Christians who were struggling with this. I would say that's also true, you're right, about other kinds of texts we have, other Gospels we have from Christianity as well. But even if we just limit ourselves to the New Testament canon, we can see in their four Gospels, not just one, that Christians are debating and talking about these things. And in that sense, I would certainly say that Paul is right, that what we've always had are Christians struggling not only with the historical data, but also, and maybe particularly, with its theological meaning.
Archbishop, do you feel in the media, and this is huge media now, and in the kind of scholarship that Karen King and others pursue, do you feel an effort to blow up the Bible in a way and permit a broader view of the origins of the faith?
Well, when you called me Archbishop, the last thing you expected was that I would quote Voltaire. But he did say on one occasion that God has created us in his image and likeness, and ever since we have been trying to return the compliment. I think sometimes we do try to craft the God that is comfortable for us, to craft the Jesus, or divide up, edit the Jesus that is comfortable for us. As a matter of fact, Jesus is not a teacher who never talked about sexuality, or a teacher who talked only about sexuality. He did mention marriage and celibacy in his teaching, but gave it a very small place. If you're looking at the volume of what he taught, he seemed much more interested in compelling us to love the Father back through him, teach us to pray, to teach us love one another and love him in one another, continue on his teaching down through the generations to establish the church. It seems to me that when you take the whole volume of what Jesus felt it was important to teach and what the first Christians felt it was important to record in those New Testament books about his teaching, it just doesn't have the kind of emphasis in subject matter that maybe modernists would be most comfortable with.
So you say there's an impulse to craft God in our own image. Of course, the conceit in the Da Vinci Code and Dan Brown's work of fiction, which is now woven through this whole conversation globally, but the conceit or the perspective there is that it's the Catholic Church itself that crafted a God in the image it chose, and then it, you know, through conspiracy and violence, you name it, Opus Dei and all the rest, that it imposed that crafted vision on its flock. What do you say to that, Archbishop?
Well, I think there's a lot of anti-Catholicism in the Da Vinci Code. I think there's a lot in American life. After all, it's as American as Mark Twain, who said, I was educated to enmity toward everything that is Catholic, and as a consequence, I tend to look only for Catholic faults, and I don't tend to find Catholic virtues. And that's still alive and well today. Senator Moynihan, the late Senator Moynihan from New York, said on one occasion that the last respectable form of bigotry, socially acceptable form of bigotry in the U.S. is anti-Catholicism. So there's some of that in there. And I think sometimes you get a dialogue of the deaf about Catholicism because the Catholics, in defending what they are defending, believe their creed, they believe their New Testament and the Old Testament, they believe in their Eucharist, they believe in their sacraments, they believe in their celebration of their faith, of reaching out to people in the community in charitable works. And when they hear the anti-Catholic coming back at them, hear anti-Catholicism coming back at them, it's usually about the Crusades and the Spanish Inquisition and so many other things that Dan Brown raises. And I think that we end up talking past each other because we form our defense or our attack around what are the thrust of our argument is.
Let me get a string of callers, if I may. So many have waited to get in here. Tom is calling from Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Tom, you're on the air. Hello, Tom, are you there, my friend? We may have lost Tom. Let me go to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Melissa. Hi, Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi.
What do you think, Melissa?
I guess I have a little bit of trouble understanding the real controversy with this book. I mean, I am a Christian. I haven't actually read the book or the movie, but I know what the premise is and the idea. And as was mentioned earlier on the program, that the New Testament really doesn't talk about whether or not Jesus was married, and it's not really relevant to the fact that I believe Jesus was fully human and he died on the cross for my salvation. And so whether he had a wife and 10 children or no wife and no children doesn't change that core theological understanding. And I think the only real difficulty maybe here is the tradition of certain denominations rather than the real theology that's being attacked.
We got it. So it's not going to shake your faith, but read it and then come back to us, Melissa. We appreciate your call very much. Let me turn to Charleston, South Carolina, and Felix. Hi, Felix, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, they're kind of missing the point on why Dan Brown wrote the Da Vinci Code. It's really all about money. And Christianity has...
And a lot of it that was made here, that's for sure.
And Christianity is an extraordinarily lucrative religion to pick on because, A, there's many followers, and B, by design, it's a religion which is a pacifist religion, which doesn't allow for you to fight back in a belligerent manner. So I'm really disappointed in people like Ron Howard and Dan Brown and Tom Hanks because I don't think they have the gumption and the gall, or they wouldn't, to make a movie, let's say, about something far more juicier like Muhammad's sexual life. I mean, for Pete's sake, he married a child and consummated his relationship with her as a child, and nobody seems to want to talk about that. Basically out of fear.
I've got it. And Felix, our time is short, but I understand, Karen King, here we are, a dozen Danish cartoons, and the Muslim world went ballistic over it. Here, you know, it's talk show grist. That's a very different response.
It is a very different response. And part of it, of course, is our lack of understanding about what Muslims are very sensitive to. But it's also the same kind of issue, I think, where we decide on one kind of voice that represents the tradition. You know, Islam has many, many voices, many moderate voices, many progressive kinds of voices within it as well. And certainly the long strand in Islam against violence.
But Felix says, look, nobody's brave enough to make a film like this and put it out as a potential blockbuster about Muhammad the Prophet.
I think that the question is exactly, who are we allowing to speak? You know, and who are we allowing then to silence our conversations so that they don't happen?
With all this conversation going on, our time grows short. Are we going to have a different understanding of Christianity 50, 100 years from now?
Yes, we are. We are definitely going to do that precisely because people are going to read this information, going to think about it. Christianity is not the same now as it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago. Every tradition, you know, not only Catholics but Protestants of various sorts are all claiming that they have the one true God. That's going to continue. These kinds of conversations are going to go on. We will have a changed Christianity. I hope it's a good one.
Archbishop Niederauer, how do you see that? With all this modern communication, so much opinion and fact and fiction floating around, do you think Christianity will be different a century from now, different in a way that you approve of?
Well, yes, I think it probably will be. I think it's interesting. Philip Jenkins has a book out about the future of Christianity, and he makes the point that right around the year 2000, for the first time since the death and resurrection of Christ, the majority of Christians have lived in the southern hemisphere, not the northern. And most of our paradigms of thinking about Christianity are, quite frankly, European and North American. And if there's going to be this huge shift in the majority to the south, I think there's going to be leadership from there, which is probably going to shape a lot of the ways we understand ourselves and the ways we express our faith, the kind of music that we use at worship, for example. Mm. I think there are going to be a lot of changes that we don't even can't even know the shape of yet.
Well, we'll see how far south Hollywood and the printing presses move at the same time. Archbishop George Niederauer, we're out of time. Archbishop of San Francisco, we're grateful to you for being with us. Thank you so much for your time. And Karen King of Harvard Divinity School. Karen, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.